Get us recording, and today is December 13th, 2021.
Close enough.
And I'm here again with Dolores Berggraf and her son, Bayer Ketzler, Al Ketzler Jr., talking about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act here at
the beginning, those early days
mm-hmm. of the land
for the interior.
Movement, for the interior. Mm-hmm. So, let's, if you wanted to review what we did the last time, and you were talking about it was a weaving.
A weaving. It is a weaving of different influences, legal bases, and addressing the kind of very nebulous at that point land, unresolved and land issues, which for a lot of the indigenous people in the interior of Alaska was very nebulous because the land was still there. There was no sense of anything being taken mm-hmm. as far as land in that early time. And this is one of the sources of it. What all evolved into this land claim issue, and one of the threads of the beginning. Now, we did separate from his position, and that was William Paul. He is a Tlingit from the southeast, and the Tlingit in that day was as far away as Texas is. For, you know, maybe we heard about Tlingits and the coastal people, but they were very remote and mm-hmm. very removed from the interior.
Right.
And the beginning of the awareness of a land issue began in Tanana with Al Starr, who, as some young man, as a student, a school teacher, I think, must have saw qualities in him and urged him to contact William Paul. And I think mostly because she was aware, possibly as a teacher, about Alaska Native Brotherhood, which was newly formed mm-hmm. in the early 1900s. Because when I met Al Starr, he was probably late 60s or 70. And I met him in like 52 or 53.
Yeah, he was born in like 1898 or
yeah,
something like
I
that.
Say, he was 60, 70 and yeah. when I met him. You know, we're talking 53 or so.
Yeah.
When I first met Al Starr, was aware of him, and he was, he narrated how this is what he learned, and how he learned it was this school teacher told him, mm-hmm. Contact William Paul. William Paul then in the, I never saw the letters. My dad, Charlie Purvis, saw the letters. Was urging Al more to about claiming land, getting, you know, some status secured of land for indigenous, and of course they called it Indians or Indian land anyway. And from that, I met William Paul, and what led him to it. Awareness, and that was from a Tsimshian with his last name was Jackson. He was a Tsimshian, and he confronted William Paul, who had become a young lawyer, and said, well, this is your land, why don't you fight for it? Mm-hmm. And that's coming from a Tsimshian, of course, which was across the border in Canada. And this is, of course, oh, I'm sure after that Duncan, that Episcopal, they call him Father Duncan, formed Metlakatla. Mm-hmm. See, he made a deal with Congress, went and lobbied Congress to get that Metlakatla Island secured for some Canadian Tsimshians that wanted to go with the Christian way, the Episcopal way. That is how Metlakatla.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I know that they're Tsimshian from Metlakatla.
They are from Tsimshian country, they are from Canada.
I didn't know they were originally from Canada.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hun, the boundaries were blurred up here.
Right.
In my time, I come in 50s, and there were Canadians working here.
Yeah.
In roles of responsibility, like the railroad depot, railroad agent.
Yeah.
And, you know, we used to shop. We had Hudson Bay access to Hudson Bay Company, and the clothing, everything was better. And that's why we ordered it.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after World War II, the U.S. government made rules, and we have to shop, you know, we had to go to, like I say, Sears and Roebuck.
Right.
And their clothing is totally, totally inadequate.
Right.
You know, for and
here.
Like I say, the boundaries up here, even in those days between Yukon and Alaska, were not really
right.
That nobody worried about. I guess they did used to in the early days at Eagle. They had military base to have customs, make
right.
sure on the river they went through a customs.
And on the
but that wasn't there anymore.
On the Chilkoot Trail, too, back in the
they
gold
had
rush,
customs
they...
at Chilkoot? Oh, for God's sake. Well, anyway, like I say, by the time, at some point, they didn't have customs anymore at Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole boundary become just, you know. And so now, then, like I say, Al Starr got in my keep. Paul is his brother. Al Starr, the father, from the information he got from William Paul about land being held in, you know, secured for indigenous people, he went on an exploration trip to see it himself.
Right, right. We talked about that the
and
last
then
time.
He came back and then tried to get people interested in instituting that
right.
toward that. And he was just, like I say, I mean, I saw it at the potlatch. I was at the potlatch. Oh, Al, go sit down. Oh, don't stir up trouble. And because, like I say, they didn't have a terrible sense of land being taken. I know when, like it, up here in Chena River, when the boats first came up, there they did bank and harbor at Chenoa,
mm-hmm.
you know the Chena people's camp,
which is
down there, right, just
the
on the
Chena site.
Yeah,
yes,
the old Chena, right.
Right.
And a lot of the Chena just evaporated down either to Minto or Nenano or over to Salsha. They just kind of moved away. But then even those people ended up moving into Fairbanks.
Right.
You know, it's kind of, there's the white world and then what was left down here. And of course, at that time, early 1900s is when those diseases hit.
Right.
That bird flu.
Right.
Decimated all over Alaska. And then the nurturing was the various churches and church hospitals. There, I don't know if there were any government hospital types instituted at that early 1900s up here for people to go for medical service. I don't know of any.
Yeah.
I mean, even the whites, you know, the whites had, in Fairbanks was the Catholic church. It made the hospital,
right.
St. Joseph Hospital.
Right.
And St. Mark's, I think, might have had a small one, but it become that become, and maybe they kind of merged the two churches, merged for the hospital.
Yeah,
you know, and
I know last time we'd sort of ended in, you know, around the 1959, 60, 61, 62, what was happening.
And that's what you were, right, you know, we were trying to, like I say, land, you know,
right.
The biggest problem, I would say, was the, number one, when the Western world came, fur was a cash crop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, trapping and hunting was traditional Native way, and you lived off of that. What you hunted, what you trapped, and what you traded with other tribes. there were major centers mm-hmm. of periods, even when wartime, they would have a moratorium on their war, if they were warring, to go ahead so they could have trade. One of the major ones, I think, was in Galena area. Major, there would be these key points where clans would meet, trade, and, you know, caribou in exchange right. for muktuk, or right. caribou skin, I should right. say. Lots of trading.
Right.
And another smaller trading was up Fort Yukon. You know, I don't know if that was influenced by Hudson Bay, you know, but I do know there was a trail from Nenana up to Fort Yukon that they would go to for mm-hmm. trade also. But, you know, how early that was, that before Hudson Bay? Is that part of the conduit maybe with the, oh, God bless, the name escapes me, the group in... Old Crow people, oh, right. the Old Crow. Because a lot of the people in the Fort Yukon really came in from Old Crow around the time of the Hudson Bay. Now there are, of course, people along Fishhook, Chokitsik mm-hmm. is Fishhook, you know, in that region, individual. But, you know, there was no big village there at Fort Yukon until the Hudson Bay and then the Steernwillers came up, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and like I say, the indigenous along the Yukon River was influenced a good solid 50 years before Nenana. And when, you know, like I say, well, I mean, I knew him, but Roger met Talbert Sean, and Danny Thomas at the same time at Wood River, because Roger and a friend went hunting up there, and they run into Talbert Sean and Danny Thomas, who were hunting at the Wood River, which was where Chief Thomas, that's where his, who was the paramount chief, that was his village. Mm-hmm. And Talbert Sean and Dan Thomas were born there, and they even had a family when that bird flu killed all of Danny's family, and not all of Talbert's, because some of Talbert's family was a Flora, mm-hmm. Quali, okay. Some was Celia. Celia was her sister. Yeah, Celia Tommy. Right, that was a sister. So, and then Marion, John was Talbert John's daughter. Marion is the one that lived next door to us. At the same time, do you remember when Flora lived next door to us? Do you remember mm-hmm. that? When you...
Before that little... Down.
Yeah, before it burned.
Yeah, not particularly.
Okay, yeah, because Flora was... she couldn't... Deaf and dumb, they call it. I don't like that. She wasn't dumb. She was deaf. But she had come and visit me. Mm. And, of course, we had to use...
You used your own sign language.
And each person, she had to create a language yeah. with herself to help us, you know. No, anyway, she'd come and visit me. And he's a little guy, about 2 years old. And he'd sit and watch our conversation with the hands. Mm-hmm. And then when Flora would leave, he would insist that we talk that way.
Yeah. You're ahead of your time. I know people who do that with their kids before they learn to speak.
So anyhow, like I say, these are my neighbors. These are my friends. Mm-hmm. These are some of my relatives, you know. I grew up as a young woman. Like I say, I mean, I knew them before I married my husband. They mm-hmm. were in my community.
Right.
And I was embraced by them. I was... Oh, how can I put it? Stunned by a lot of what they had to go through. Mm-hmm. So many of them, what I saw was beautiful, friendly people who then when you just scrape away a little, my God, the devastating losses yeah. they had.
Hard life.
Then the confusion, languages and rules, and, you know, disparaging of their way of life. Like, I mean, they were, whoa, I mean, talk about cultural impact.
Yeah.
And then how do I navigate it without aggravating it, which of course I did. I mean, I grew up, oh my God, like I say, my own world was blown away.
Right.
My knowledge that I knew what a Leghorn was and a Holstein and a Palomino and was totally irrelevant in this world.
Right.
And I'm trying to find what is relevant in this world.
Yeah, well, so...
And they didn't know what was relevant either. They're trying to find out the same thing that I am. But coming from a land-based culture, where land, everything come from the land, even before money.
Yeah.
My people, my dad's people, did not have money. They had land, and they worked it in a different way than hunting and trapping. They worked it in, you
cows.
Know, the seeds.
And cows.
And they had horses. That's what, you know, they didn't have canoes. They had horses. But you had to plant 20 acres to feed that horse so that horse could plow your ground. So, you know, like I say, you know, the everything was work. And it was hard work. And there were their life. They had no leisure time.
Right.
It was hard work.
It was hard work, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was wondering that.
And so my culture and their culture had ways that kind of fit crudely.
Yeah.
Hand in glove, well, not exactly, but yet you could have a feel and a sense.
Because I wondered how the collaboration of non-native allies and into the native community in those early days of land claims, how that worked and how you felt like you were accepted into their community. How you navigated that.
You'd have to ask them why. And of course it got compounded when I married a local boy who is half, you know, and he wasn't exactly local because his mother had been brought in as a young child with her sisters and kind of dumped in Nenana. They were foreign people. It's kind of like somebody bringing in some French kids and dumping them in Spain. And they, you know, send these, the Minto people adopted my mother-in-law, a Minto family, who is
the
elderly.
The
John Titus took her in, and I don't know where the other girls, who took them in? One of them married.
Martha married Chief Thomas,
Oh, yeah, Martha was right. Right, Chief Thomas, that's right.
That was his
exactly. And she had passed away by the time I came, that girl. And one of them was named Pearl that married a Berg, a man. Mm-hmm. I don't know who took her in until she was marriageable. And of course, marriageable is 13, 14.
Yeah, well, you were 16 when you got married,
in
right?
In those days, yeah. And so I learned a lot about the rules that when you were a young woman and you were, the important, you know, thing was your menstrual cycle, where you were absolutely secluded away from, you were not allowed to see any man or any man see you. I mean, that was taboo, and you were isolated for about a month.
Even in the 50s, even?
So much in the 50s, but it was just before, their mothers were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, they remembered, they told us about how
Yeah.
And then another, and it varied in different little, you know, Minto to whatever, Tanana, whatever. When you were a young woman, you were isolated at home for a period of time, which depended, a month or so, maybe for some families, but other families, maybe a year. You managed the whole household for a period of time, so that you had your credentials to be married.
That's how you learned,
Yeah, you learned by doing. And you knew how to do it. And you knew the importance of knowing when and what, you know, you had to be that, like I say, that was the credentials.
Yeah.
right. for marriageable woman. Once you pass whatever that test was in that locality, then okay, you're okay. She's appropriate for, yeah. And like I say, hon, all of these little social and all these rules, I'm aware of that, you know? And then I'm aware of this new set of rules about, oh, my little, I had a sister-in-law who was so funny because she would be obviously pregnant. Now, you know, in my culture, you never use the word pregnant. Even my southern little white woman culture, you were with child. Oh, right. And pregnant, to be that, was almost like a dirty word, you know? And, well, my little sister-in-law would be with child, but I mean, we didn't use that term. She would wear in July this long wool coat. And of course, we knew when Clara, you know, when, no, Caroline had this long coat on, that meant she was pregnant, and we didn't mention it. And you, like I say, there were some of the women who were still quite rigid about that being that frank. Now, other of my neighbors would come over and, oh, I'm pregnant, darn it, you know, like Elizabeth or whatever. You know, like I say, it'd be frank, right up front. And, you know, even though, well, she's raised at the mission, though.
But it sounds like Nanana in that time period was a mixed community, well, and everybody got along.
When I saw Little Big Man, that was my Bible. Oh, my God, that was my whole portrayal of, over here, I'm with that old rule, with that tribe. You go across the street, a whole different set of rules. And then over here, you're with some Baptist. And over here, you're with some Catholic. And over here, it could be, I mean, I'm crazy making.
Did people get along, or was there conflict?
There was a statuses. You know, there was naturally the certain whites were, of course, above the whole bunch. And then there were whites who had married in. Well, they lost status a little bit, you know. And let's see, what did they call them? Oh, I don't know. They had a word for them. And then, well, within the natives, too. I mean, my little friend, oh, God. Anyway, it was, she was a bit older than me, but she is narrating her difficulty to her father, who was Irish, but her mother was from Ruby area. And it had been an arranged marriage. And her, the mother's name, I'll give her that name, Rose, was arranged to marry this Irishman, because white men treat you better. Her father had made that arrangement because white men will treat you better. Now, I had another friend whose mother, which was Wilma's mother, advised Wilma to marry a white man because they treat you better. And I remember my mom, when Wilma was sharing with Roseanne, my sister, that, you know, what her mother said, my mom was just startled and kind of outraged, you know, because my mom knows how white men are.
I was going to say, white men don't necessarily
like,
treat you better.
Are you kidding? Yeah. So like I say, there was these silly superstitions. I mean, hon, you can't imagine the collision of superstitions.
Right.
And there is, I think, you know, again, I can't say that for sure, but I mean, I know the white men superstitions about natives having an easy life. Okay, oh, you just had to hunt and fish. I mean, oh, what a life. And the women did all the work. You know what I mean? Okay, oh, that's a piece of cake, you know. And that's a superstition. And on the other hand, I think in the native world, the white man has it so easy. Then the white women had it so easy. They don't have to do anything, just whatever. And of course, they're both, I mean, the work of being a white woman or a white man, you know the work of it and the hazards of it. and how hard it is to be in your own world, in your own culture. Mm-hmm. And of course, none of us in the U.S. are in our own cultures, because it is a blend of European, that we bring a whole set of different rules and standards, and somehow,
right.
you know, a constitution keeps us knitted together.
Right.
Sort of. and so it's just as bad, you know.
That she, because she brings up a good question, you haven't really answered it, but the aspect of the Native culture really trusting who they were dealing with,
right? Which, the confusion.
What white man can you trust?
You the story of like Chief Andrew Isaac appointing Ruth Charles to be the delegate to go mm-hmm. to the Tanao Chiefs meeting. And she had developed a trust. She was married into the Native community.
Yeah, from Doris Tanao, Charles from, was her mother-in-law.
From mm-hmm. Tanao Cross?
From Dot Lake.
Dot Lake. Cross region, yeah.
Because
okay.
mm-hmm. he was the chief of all
right.
that whole area.
Right.
And and she, you know, her role in a sense that she could type, she could write, she could speak English
and
really
that's...
good, and so anyway, that was, you know.
I would call it a conduit, and that's exactly what happened to me. See, one reason I was a delegate to the Tanana Chiefs Conference, to the first and second, was I got the job of being a secretary for the Nenana Native Council. I got a phone call, which I was one of the rare people, because my husband, Al Ketzler, was the union dispatcher for the union. Mm-hmm. And the union provided us with a telephone so that if the UTANA, you know, called for a worker or whatever kind of foreman or forklift operator or deckhand or whatever, call Al Ketzler, and it would, the conduit would be through the union dispatcher. And that's what Al was, so we had a phone. So I get a phone call from, of course I get a phone call. I mean, the phone ring and I answer it, because it's in my little cabin. That's where the headquarters were. Anyhow, it's Paul Esau. Paul Esau asked me if I'd be secretary for the Nenana Native Council. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because I wanted to address, in that little town was maybe half a dozen people that I call keeping the flame alive. And about the only flame they could keep alive, because their laws were thrown out and not honored or recognized, was maybe some cultural traditional dances and traditional get-togethers at the Native Hall. Now, there had been the one Native Hall that, when before I married your dad, it got burned down when you were a baby. It had caught on fire. No, hon. No, it was next to where Paul George lived. It was a large, old, you know, kind of like it would look like an abandoned building to anybody else, but that's where they met when they had Native dances and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Sam George, which was Paul George's father, when I came, Sam and Bella were the chief. And, of course, they were functioning as chief in a world where their laws were not respected, acknowledged, or da. But there was that was held. And then, remember now, Frank became chief. Frank mm-hmm. Alexander became chief. Right. And at some point, that's when Charlie and him mm-hmm. were really good buddies. Mm-hmm. And Charlie, I mean, like I say, Frank kind of took Charlie under his wing and mm-hmm. took care of him
right.
in a sense that they'd go hunting together. Well, mm-hmm. Charlie's foot gear was horrible, and little Daisy weighed him a pair of real native decent foot gear. Mm-hmm. And Charlie just was loving it. I mean, no, his feet have never been so warm, and you know, they're easy to wear, light, and they, you know, had their hunting times together. They had their adventures. They even went gold prospecting one time. Mm-hmm. And that was a long story because, like I say, that was going on.
As you say, trust is the key component.
Yeah, the key aspect. Yeah, that's why she was trusted, you know. Charlie, you know, my grandfather, he had developed the same kind of reputation that he was a white man that you could trust.
Yeah.
And with the help of the chief, being a friend of the chief at that time.
But the fact that the chief, he gained the trust of the chief. Mm-hmm. So there was something about these particular non-native people, Charlie and you and Kay Hitchcock and
Kay was a whole later thing. You're getting way ahead where we are at
what,
that time.
What it was about them that was worth trusting? Or
I would say culture. Yeah, that was culture, but it was the way they were brought in as well. About who brought them into the picture.
Oh, who brought him in?
The chief brings you in.
If you bring you in, right. If Charlie had bring somebody in, they would respect that. It was... And as well as, you know, a lot of these people that were brought in, if it was Barry Oss Miller, if it was Sandy, they all had credentials, you might say. Mm-hmm. And the Native community understood credentials. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're an English
teacher.
Well,
we're getting way ahead It's a big leap.
It's a bigger leap ahead
of where we were in those early times.
Right.
And what we're navigating and what you're trying to... And Charlie, a farm boy, mm-hmm. coming up here, of course, land. There was a farm that was under the jurisdiction of that Jones that we stayed in their house, you know, when we first came. Oh, God, I can't remember his first name now. Tom Jones, I think it was. He's the one that had run as a legislator. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever got elected, but... You know, when we boarded before we got mm-hmm. our own cabin, we boarded with Tom Jones. Right. Charlie had met him, and they had dialogue. I guess they had some kind of common interest because this Tom Jones ended up with a farm called the Peterson Farm that the river swallowed up much years later.
In Nenana.
And Nenana was a farm homesteaded, apparently, by a guy named Peterson. And Charlie and Tom Jones were negotiating on Charlie was going to work that land, that farm. Mm-hmm. It had cleared land. Charlie is a farm boy. And hun, land was sacred to a farm.
Right. That's a common thread, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I don't know how to put it. I mean, Charlie was very troubled at hungry children and hungry people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really disturbed him. And you know, Charlie saw, you know, I don't know how to put it. It's like in our bones, everything come from the land.
Right.
I don't care if you live in New York. Everything you have in New York come from the land. But in New York, your purpose is to push nature out.
Right.
There is no such thing. And yet someday they are going to find out nature is there and in charge. And in the meanwhile, we innately know that. Right. And in the native world, the relationship with animals was similar. Right. I mean, my dad knew animals like you know your children.
Right.
Every child has its own distinct needs and nature and personalities. Every animal does too. Mm-hmm. It has its own nature and animal, and Charlie could speak to them all, you know. And at least he could speak to me. Now, he had another daughter he could not speak to. She did not speak his language. Mm-hmm. She spoke her mother's language. And Charlie and his wife did not speak each other's language, even though they were both agricultural. But his wife's language was more Southern white woman, probably prior people that had slaves. Mm-hmm. That culture, a whole different culture than Charlie's Southern Missouri, you fight for freedom, you die for freedom. Nobody has dominion on you, mm-hmm. okay? And so anyhow, like I say, I mean, I know about culture collision. Because those two had it, and oddly enough, they were both agricultural. But their way of their managing their relationship with land and models are totally different from their backgrounds. So I grew up in a mixed culture marriage, right. And they were both white.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Well, and you had mentioned being the secretary, that Paul Esau mm-hmm. asked you to be the secretary. Mm-hmm. And you think, you know, talking before about how astute and smart the Native Alaskans were before the Western way, you know, and that they knew that you had typing skills.
Okay, well, this
and
is
they
what
knew to
made,
come to you.
Right, and like I say, that's like Andrew Isaac
right.
went to her.
They knew.
That's kind of the same reason I assume they came to me.
Right.
Because they knew, I knew how to do the, and a lot of, and you know, like I say, who was Sam George and Bell, you know, all of them did not read and write English.
Right.
They spoke very broken English. Right. And now I ended up, I said, oh, of course, Paul, I'd be glad to help. Well, then I later found out I'm running for office against, you know who, and I don't want you to mention it. Anyway, I did not know I was running for office, and I did not even begin to even, what do you call it?
Campaign?
Campaign, yeah.
So to be the secretary, you
and I ended up getting elected.
So the secretary was an elected position for the Native Council?
Well, no, all of it. Chiefs, too. By that time, it had modified to election.
Because it was a tribal council.
Well, it's tribal, but yet, like now, I don't think,
Process.
Okay.
Sam George, you know, Paul's father, I don't think he had been elected. When he died, for some reason, it became elected. And I think it was trying to model the white man's mayor. Mm-hmm. They got elected.
So there was a city mayor of Nenana
well? Oh, yeah. Nenana had their white mayor, right. You know, their white chamber of commerce. Okay. And then, so they have an elected chief. And I'm sure, I don't think they had it for Sam George, but after he passed, they had.
And so what,
and I know, I think maybe Frank might have been their first elected chief. Mm-hmm. Frank Alexander, yeah.
And so what year did you start being the secretary?
Well,
do you remember?
I was married and, oh golly, was I pregnant with Stephanie?
It's probably 59, probably.
Earlier. 60. It was earlier. Mm-hmm. It was earlier. Maybe, well, maybe you're right. No, well, yeah, 58.
Well,
maybe 58. 60. Maybe 58, okay. Hon.
Well, 58, 59.
I would say 58 was probably better.
Somewhere.
Because 59, hon, by 59, mm-hmm. I'm involved with land claims at the meetings. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. And 59 is when the A&B chapter was organized.
Stephanie. And that's when what?
The A&B chapter in Nenana
right.
got organized.
And that's
in
toward the end of it, hon.
That was
I
in
mean,
59.
Yeah, late 59.
I have May 59.
No, late. Late, like...
And the Copper Center group also.
No, wait.
I don't know
we're jumping
year.
Around. See, like I say, we're jumping away.
Okay, that's what I'm
Copper
saying.
Center... people already were Alaska Native Brotherhood,
okay.
and they were in Charlie's world
okay.
because of statehood. Markle, there was a group of Alaskans, And there weren't very many Alaskans. Like I say, we were under 200,000 mm-hmm. people in the whole country, counting dogs. And there was less, I mean, maybe 150,000 people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many indigenous, which a lot of them had died from disease.
Right.
And in the white world was most of them Anchorage and Fairbanks, and I don't know how much Juneau and all of that. But anyhow, this notion of statehood started before land claims.
Yes, yes.
And that was involved in Alaska Independence Party. They did not want, they wanted Alaska to become its own nation. And so was Markle Ewan involved.
Okay.
And so was the Hitchcocks. And I suppose maybe Nilo Kopanen and he was probably a member of the Alaska Independence Party and separate nation of Alaska under the jurisdiction of kind of like the same of Canada and Britain. You know,
right.
Canada at that time was still under, it was separate, but under British.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that, of course, broke away. Oh, they were handed complete clearance way in the 60s or 70s before they now are their own nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more, it wasn't like an opposition to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to run their own country.
Okay. And so Markle Ewan was from...
And he's Gulkana.
Oh, Gulkana.
And, God, these other men's names. Oscar Craig was Copper Center. Charlie, oh, God, what was his first name? He was very knowledgeable in white man's land law. I forget his first
the
name.
The big tall guy with glasses?
No, they were they're Copper Center people. Copper Center, they're about the same. But I forget his first name. I forget his first name.
I got pictures of him.
Got pictures of them.
He's a big, but tall
I do know.
So they came, did they come and join you
well,
guys?
No, they weren't there. They're not even involved in tribal stuff.
Okay.
They're involved in
statehood stuff.
In statehood stuff, right.
Okay.
And to be a state or not.
Right.
And because really statehood was not even in the picture when we came.
Right.
It got invented and started being pushed
right
down the throat, so to speak.
But by 59, 60,
yeah.
When you guys
see, maybe after we got married was then it
right.
The statehood.
Well, and I say
sure, I know people had been weaving through that, but
right.
We weren't aware.
Right. And I would say by the 59, 60, when you guys started talking land rights and
well, wait, you got to understand.
Statehood was already there. We became a state in 59.
Right, but right by the time we right, it was a dead issue.
Right,
because we were a state, but
right.
Prior to that, you know, these people like Kay Hitchcock's husband. Was, I think he got elected under the Alaska
Territory,
Alaska statehood.
The Constitution.
Alaska Independence Party.
Oh.
I think he got in some elected, and he died of a heart attack, which him and Kay had homesteaded,
right,
in what they call Caribou Creek, which I do not know where that is, somewhere on the highway,
yeah,
down. Maybe Cantwell or past Cantwell? I have no idea where Caribou Creek is. Mm-hmm. And he was in Independence. And Kay was Quaker. I don't know if he was Quaker. See, we have the Quaker connection. We have the Unitarian Universalist connection, which Charlie was the only Universalist. See, the Universalist was a separate group.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie was the only Universalist. The Unitarians were their group. And Charlie was kind of this needle that poked and threaded through the Quakers, the Unitarians.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, was the involvement with the religious groups and the churches with land claims.
Well, okay,
then.
Well, you got to stop. You're jumping ahead. Okay, let me tell you, when we had our first chiefs conference, the Catholic Church and the Episcopal Church had a fit.
How come?
For very good reasons. They were given dominion. They had power. Number one, you got to go back to the United States and the agreement they made with the Tsarina, right? To educate, to provide medical services, the United States government.
This is for the missions to come to Alaska.
No. You've got to understand, the United States made a deal with Russia in the contract.
Right.
To provide those services of educating. And this is William Seward we're talking about.
Right.
Made that deal. Okay, as you know, the United States had a stupid, horrible civil war. They had no money. So they called a meeting to the churches. They would give the churches land in return for them coming and educating and providing medical services. And some churches met, some turned it down. Wisely, as a corruption of separation of church and state. Now, the Presbyterians came. Remember, S. Hall Young was the first Presbyterian, and he got the Southeastern. The Yukon River, pretty much, let's see, it was kind of divided up with the Catholic and Episcopal. And somehow a Quaker group got Kotzebue.
Yeah. The Friends.
The Presbyterians and the Episcopals got the North Slope. I think Point Hope was Episcopal. I think Presbyterian was Barrow.
Yeah, Barrow was Presbyterian.
Right.
I don't remember Point Hope.
Point Hope was Episcopal.
That must have been the boundary line.
And Interior here was Episcopal in Nenana, and there wasn't any mission, Catholic mission, in Fairbanks until the church, St. Mark's and whatever the Catholic church is down there, and they made that church, hospital.
St. Joseph's.
Yeah, they never had a mission. Right. Up here, but they had
the
hospital.
The Moravians were in the lower,
and the Moravians Kuskokwim. Were the Kuskokwim, right.
And there were some Russian Orthodox.
Yeah.
Well, and Russian Orthodox had come in. What year did Vitus Bering come in? I mean, 1740 or something.
Something like that.
Middle 17.
Yeah, the whole that.
And of course, it was a while before the
Kodiak Aleut, all that.
And that, right, they were there a good 100 years before.
Yeah, all that's Russian Orthodox. Mm-hmm. So the churches were given, what did you say, 200 acres?
400, to my understanding.
No, hon, I don't.
They were the largest landowners.
They were
there. Private landowners in Alaska.
I never heard.
Before the Native Americans.
Yeah, I never ever heard of how much land.
Okay.
But and they had almost like government power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In St. Mary's, and they designated where the people could put their fish wells, put their houses. They had speaker systems into the homes. To announce prayer, to announce time to go to church. And I mean, hon, there,
Santa Nicholas is that way. Still might be, actually.
Yeah.
And anyhow, when we had our first chief's conference, boy, did they blast us.
They were threatened.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. The medicine men rose up. Same thing. Same kind of thinking, same kind of behavior. Their power is God. You know that. So what, white man's God.
What did they do? Did they write letters, or what was? How did they?
You go refer to the Newsminer in that year, okay. And you will. They had a thousand, whatever number you want to give, years of experience up here. And they determined that by so-and-so was here 50 years, so-and-so was here 25, and they added up all of those years that these priests had been here, and it added up to 1,000 years. They had Aboriginal rights. Uh-huh. Well, oh, I tell
but
you.
But eventually the churches became allies.
And that took a while.
Yeah. How did that come about?
I don't even know.
I think it by priest by priest.
Right. Okay, like for instance, in Nenana. Mm-hmm. Okay, the priests really, I mean, they were, oh, the churches. Anyway, one good man was in Nenana called, Father Phillips, yes. What was his first name, you know? I don't know either. I can't think of it.
No, probably not.
Father Phillips. And his wife was Carol. John Phillips, okay. And his wife was Carol. And I knew them. And I enjoyed him. And I even went to the house a time or two and washed a pile of dishes because when you're the wife of a priest, people are dropping in all the time. And I mean, anyway, like I say, and I knew they were good. Now, John comes from an interesting background. He comes from a communist background, but not Russian communists. It was a lower 48 communist group. Back East had quite a few different
In the 1920s and 30s,
That's where he was raised in that world. Huh. But he married a woman that I don't think was raised in that world. But in the meanwhile, he turned into Episcopal priest. And how that happened, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the kids were known, because I know Carol and John are both gone.
Right.
And but anyway, he come to Nenana. And, I'm remembering the priest before him was Stratman. And I remember Stratman telling me his image of his role and responsibility of the priesthood, which was not at all like John Phillips. But anyway, back to John, that, like I say, the church is turmoil, and all of this was going on, and of course, like I say, we're back in Nenana, and it's months later, and all this. Oh, I mean, that first chief's meeting just created a wave, tsunami, just in Florida. Like I say, we're blasted as communists. We're
this is the 62 meeting,
right?
Yeah,
the first one in Tanana.
In Tanana.
Yeah, that's when we went really public,
right?
And what you call it? Tom Snapp was down there at the first meeting, I think, in Tanana.
Yeah, there's pictures of him.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was at the one in Nenana, too, you know, when Mary Alice Miller came. But anyway.
That one was earlier.
Still in Nenana before we envisioned doing it again at Tanana. And so anyway, I don't know exactly what kind of tension yet was being felt by Al, because of course he's the point man. And I told him, I said, you know, Al, go talk to, you know, Father Phillips. I said, go talk to him. And, you know, because I knew he would hear him. Mm-hmm. He would have an ability to hear. A lot of people can't hear. They don't want to hear what they don't want to hear, okay? And I knew John Phillips would hear him. And Al went and talked, and I was not present. I can only narrate what his dad reported to me. And so, you know, they had their little back and forth on what was going on and what was it about. And John said, well, he would have a real problem if there was, you know, a cash settlement, and it's like he named a name, would get all that money. And Al's response was, well, I wouldn't have any problem with that unless she asked me. In other words, if you got a pocket full of money, it's none of my business. But if you ask me, then I would have a concern. And anyway, John got the point. Now, for a white to think of a native getting a pocket full of money was scary. That's their superstition.
Yeah, that was the church's overall stance at that time.
Well, they managed. They were considered to be, and I mean, like I say, it was just that, it was that paternalistic. Yeah. That see, the Presbyterians were different.
They still had it.
They had it, but they educated. I mean, that is Metlakatla. You know, Father Duncan had a different policy than the Episcopal, patronizing.
Yeah. And Sheldon Jackson was Presbyterian.
And he was Presbyterian. And right, and they did get out of Tlingit country. They had lawyers and et cetera.
Right.
Way before any notion.
Well, so it sounds like some of that transition for the churches was, as you say, individual priests, person to person. Al talked to one priest.
Oh, the ones that had the most, oh my God.
That it's all about individual relationships.
Yeah. Well, like I said, yeah, the ones that, they never ever came in support of it, right, was the Catholic.
But later in Nyan claims, like, Emil Noddy went out to the...
Okay, well, then you got to back up some more.
Right, no, I know
that
was later.
Because Charlie Purvis, when he moved stateside in 1968...
Right.
He traveled all over to different churches, to different churches, and told them what was going on in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And some heard him and some didn't. But when Emil went out to around the time of when that big Democratic Party had that in Chicago,
that was 68.
He went out and, anyway, the churches knew what he was talking about. He never ever, I don't think, wondered how the hell did they know, and they voted to back land claims.
Right. And so it was,
and
because
then,
Charlie...
like I say, I know the Episcopal, I think, and toward the end of land claims, sent $10,000 to AFN. I mean, much needed money.
Right.
Emil,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Emil, I mean, like I say, he worked for years, and like, you know, his wife divorced him because they were sharing a can of beans. They had a child. I mean, the wife had it, you know.
So did Charlie go to Quaker churches?
He went anywhere. When he was stateside, he'd talk to any institution. And the churches were the door.
Right.
You know.
Do you know how he found out about them, or he just...
Honey, their churches are everywhere in the
lower
48.
Just go knock on the door?
He grew up.
Yeah.
Well, he'd engage, and usually there's a social director.
Right.
They want a spokesperson and somebody exotic from Alaska to talk about Alaska Native and blah, blah, blah. And some of them would shut the door, you know? I mean, like I say.
But a lot of the churches that he went to, they would call ahead and say, okay, we had a guest speaker, I think you need to hear what he said.
Oh, right.
And they would... You drive that community.
And I mean,
church.
When Al went outside, what the heck did Al go out for? Oh, he stopped to visit Charlie when Charlie was in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. He was heading, I guess, over to Bill Beiler, or maybe he came back and stopped to see Charlie. Mm-hmm. But Charlie called up the Kansas City Star and got a reporter because Al Kessler, the head of the Verlante, I mean, it's in there. You know,
right.
I saw the little bit of little thing in the column of publicity. I mean, Charlie knew, he knows machines.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows how to turn the ignition on them. And some of them, of course, the battery is dead.
That's a great metaphor. machines and
Charlie had only, like I say, 5 years of formal schooling.
Now, so you said he moved to Kansas City in
1968. He moved back to the lower 48. And then he came back in 71, I think, or 2.
Yeah, because I thought he passed away up here.
He came back, I think, in 72 or something.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of when the church changed their stance. But
he was in anti-war by then.
Right.
He was outside
it was
anti-war.
Probably in 67, 68.
But they started Bishop changing.
Gordon, yeah.
So it was,
no, wait.
When the churches started coming on board.
Episcopal Church especially.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I say, Bishop Gordon, there was a big to-do in the press. Bishop Gordon decided at Point Hope that the graveyard belonged to the Episcopal. Okay, here is all these Inupiat bodies out there. And some little Inupiat dared to become, I don't know, a Baptist or something. And when they died, Bishop Gordon wouldn't let her be buried in the Point Hope. Mm-hmm. And that, because he decided it was Episcopal.
Right, because he was the bishop for the Episcopal
Church.
But yet,
I'm sure those bodies had been there before the Episcopal Church, a lot of them.
Yeah, and his wife is surely still alive.
Could be.
No, she is.
She's still alive. Yeah. Wow, she must be in her 90s.
She must be way young.
Yeah, she's a friend of a friend of mine. So I was surprised too.
So anyhow, that was a big boo-hoo before land claims.
Right, but so in 62, look, can you...
And another issue before land claims that made the news, and I was married then, and that is the duck scandal.
Right, in Barrow, the duck
in Barrow, right, mm-hmm. right. Like I say, before land claims, it was hunting and fishing issues more than, you know, the people felt it. Because like I say, that's the economy, stupid.
The duck inn and Project Chariot.
Like I say, now you wanted to know the threads that connected.
Right.
And now we're back again. And that Project Chariot did happen before the duck thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I say, these crazy ideas, number one, somebody dreams up Project Chariot. And then over here, somebody dreams up Rampart Dam.
Right.
And then that created, because Turok Newman at, I forget if the first or second Tanana Chiefs meeting, when Turok Newman, you know, came to Dad, when Dad was at the meeting, and, you know, Turok told, you know, Charlie, well, I'm opposed to Rampart Dam. And Charlie said, well, he was a delegate from Beaver.
Right.
And Charlie said, well, bring it to the floor, you know. And that's when, I forget who was there. I think it was Roscoe Bell. He was, I think, the Attorney General.
He was.
And anyhow, Turok got up, and I am opposed to the Rampart Dam. And man, you hold the whole floor just, and then me too, you know, Fort Yukon, as you know, like I say, it's just me too. And then the Corps of Engineers were there. That's kind of, the Corps of Engineers were there.
Right.
And they started then advocating why this is such a, oh, it'll make it warmer, all of that water will make it warmer. And one of them, there was a piece, he had a map up there of where, if he had a choice, he would choose this piece of land right here, which kind of jutted out like that into this lake that would be formed. This was
like
kind of where Rampart is, where Rampart would be the highest.
Canyon, so.
And he would put, you know, he right there. And Percy Herbert from Fort Yukon, he gets up and he said, he would, that north wind in the winter will come through and blow over that lake. And anyway, it made it look like a pretty stupid idea. And anyhow, then we had in our committee meeting, which I was in, until those impacted by Rampart Dam agreed we would stand with them in opposition. That's what the whole group, and I was on that committee.
Alfred Grant was the funniest one.
Oh, Alfred Grant. He made a funny one.
Yeah.
Because Percy continued with pointing out that in Fort Yukon for a number of years, they had no school building. The one school building for elementary had been declared by fire departments, as you know, but yet the kids were still going to school there. And another building that there was used, I forget what was, maybe a condemned, I don't know, but anyway, and he says it's going to take at least 20 years for those water to get to Fort Yukon. So for 20 years, our kids are going to have these inadequate buildings for their education. And Roscoe Bell got up and stood up and says, well, he doesn't know about that school situation, but when he gets back to Juneau, he'll check into it. Al Grant from Tanana stands up and says, Al's going to make a point, but what he did say, and I remember this, but I don't remember the point he made after. He said, first of all, I want to thank Mr. Roscoe Bell for promising to educate my Fort Yukon brothers before he drowns them. We fell on the floor. Oh my God, all of us. I mean, hon, our benches were very crude.
That's awesome.
I mean, you know, it was not,
yeah, I've
you
seen
know.
The pictures of them.
Oh my, anyway. Yeah. If he made a point after that for Tanana's behalf, I don't remember what it was.
That's
but
great.
Anyhow.
So were there,
were
there minutes from this meeting?
Clarabelle Charlie kept them. I mean, she didn't keep them. She made them.
You do? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Clarabelle would have to be, hon, anybody that did shorthand, only they can translate their own shorthand.
Mm-hmm. So Clarabelle Charlie was the
somebody
secretary.
Somebody typed them up. I thought you typed them up.
No.
But yeah, they're nicely typed.
Okay.
In a professional
I never
form.
Saw that. I only know Clarabelle's shorthand.
And was it in Athabascan or
no, no,
is
no.
in English?
Oh, no, because these are mixed languages.
Okay.
Tanana, you know, that was all different languages. I mean, Fort Yukon Gwich'in is not.
Fort Yukon is Gwich'in, but.
In the meanwhile.
Oh, Fredson.
Oh, Bill Fredson.
Yeah.
That's Lou
Bill.
Young's brother.
Right, that's the name I couldn't remember. They were trying to remember Fredson.
Yeah, Bill Fredson is from Fort Yukon. He's adorable. Bill Fredson is Lou Young. Yeah. And he maybe was second year or first year. I'm not sure. Because those meetings, I have to admit, as the years gone by, are merging in my head. And who was who? Because one of the first meeting is when Kennedy had some kind of a committee come up or whatever to...
There was the Department of Interior's Task Force on
Task
Alaska Native
Force.
Affairs.
Yeah.
That was the
right.
62 meeting in town.
Yeah, there was the task force.
And
then, of course, like I say, we had the Corps of Engineers that, you know...
Yeah, they were at that same meeting because they're in the pictures.
Yeah.
But their presentation with their map.
And then one of them, too, we had the Metlakatla mayor came because he wanted support for the fish traps. Metlakatla was allowed four fish traps in their treaty, but that was, of course, in jeopardy, and he wanted support for that. I forget his first name. I remember his last name was Ryan, and from Metlakatla.
I forget how many tribes were actually represented.
32, I think.
32, I think, yeah.
That's the number I've heard.
Yeah, could have been even more.
Yeah.
No, I don't think more.
But, you know, how did you get...
Glen Allen from, you know,
the whole
southeast.
So, yeah, how did you get everybody...
Does Tyonic, anybody send from Tyonic?
Well, like I say, now, one of those years, I remember coming in, your dad and I come in, I think, with Mark Stella, who was the pilot who brought us in. And I think Mark had also brought in Ruth and Doris Charles. Now, the first year is when Charlie got that plane, right?
The first year, yeah, he got the big chart.
Yeah, Charlie, right. That's Charlotte charted some big old World War II
like
plane.
The Ween.
Ween. I was thinking it was a Ween airplane.
And from leftover from World War II.
And so that came from Fairbanks to Tanama?
He had them land at the villages
to pick up the delegates.
They had long enough airstrips for a big plane like that?
Well, see, during World War II, they had CAA all of that over. Yeah, because we were under military.
Right, out in...
Some villages like Stevens Village stuff, of course they didn't, or Rampart.
Did they come by boat then?
And there was those that come by boat. Minto.
The nearby
ones. There was a pretty good sized delegation from Minto that came in by boat.
The side was full of boats.
Yeah. And I think, is that the year Ted Hetzel came?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, Ted Hetzel and Charlie brought Charlie and Ted Hetzel down.
Okay. Yeah. By boat.
By boat from Nanana, because they were laid over. They were late in getting there, and I remember Clarabelle was frightened and very concerned. Mm-hmm. And she kind of burst into tears. She was concerned about her dad. And anyway, of course, when the dad came, he was irritated at his daughter for being concerned about him. And, you know, I said, "Well, we didn't even get wet," he says, you know. I mean, she, you know, in his mind, but she'd grown up in the mission and stuff. See, her mother for years had TB and had been taken, Clarabelle and Millie were little girls. And the mother, Winnie, was in...
Did she go to Sitka?
In Sitka. And at some point, Bishop Gordon was coming in. Now, like, Winnie wanted the children to be put in the mission, but the mission had a policy of not taking kids under 8. Hmm. Well, they're too little, you know. Yeah. And anyhow, when the Bishop Gordon was visiting the hospitals, I guess he must have been in Sitka, she was on a table for some reason in examining room or something, and he come in to say hello to her. And she begged him, "Please take my kids." Mm. And he explained, "Well, no, we have a policy." She got off of that, got on her knees, and begged him, "Take my girls." And he did. It was hard on them. They were so little.
Yeah.
They were just little kids. I mean, really, what a shock to be pulled out of Minto.
Yeah.
But that's how the Shire then were raised in the mission for their early years. And then when, she was in the hospital 5 years. She's one of them that lives. Mm-hmm. Half of them that went in did not come out alive.
Yeah. So the first meeting in Nanana earlier in 62, I think it was, March, April, whatever it was.
No, that wouldn't have been 62. That had been 59.
The first meeting.
You guys had some meeting in Nanana before the Tanana one.
Yeah.
Right. And that had to be earlier, when I was pregnant with Stephanie.
I have that it was earlier in 62, but it could have been 61.
Oh, it was earlier. It was 59. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Yeah, 59 in Nanana, then in 60, 59 was, it was like November or something. Like I say, Kay came down in the holiday.
That was the first thing with, and then what?
And then the second one was in February with Minto. That is 1960.
Okay.
The next one, and that's when Mary Alice Miller.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Oh, and then they had the next one in March. Mm-hmm. that's when about 9 villagers came to that one, and that's when they remembered about Nuchilawaya.
Right, right. That's when and that's the one to. I'm asking about.
Okay.
That was in, do you remember, was that
in
60?
March.
March was 61?
No,
62?
It had to be the same year.
Yeah.
62. So 62.
Yeah.
Right.
So well, then, okay, then when Kay must have come down in 60, maybe I was pregnant with Stuart. I was pregnant. I'm always pregnant.
I love how you said that's how you delineate time is who I was pregnant
with. Yeah, and already I've got the two kids messed up here,
they're
you know?
Too close together. But so anyway, this March meeting mm-hmm. in Nenana,
mm-hmm.
who came together and why?
Well, it was held in Frank Alexander's house, former chief, because like you say, the chief Nenana did not want to touch
right.
the issue.
Okay.
And
you said 9 villages?
And 9 villages, and it was Arlie Charlie from Tanana. Of course, Minto was there.
Was that Richard Frank?
No, Richard never came, and I'm not, that does not discount him.
No.
Because Richard spoke at, come to Fairbanks from Nenana.
He came in later.
And, like I say, at times, I mean, Richard, oh, and there's another part of the story that you don't even have yet.
Okay.
But anyway, back to
so,
who was president.
Minto.
God bless. Oh, man.
What are you trying to think of the delegate from
yeah.
Minto?
Well, like I say, that 9 people that came to mm-hmm. the... Now, I did not attend that meeting.
Okay.
I was not there. It was held at Frank's house. And Grant Newman took the notes.
Okay.
Grant Newman was only just peripherally involved. But like I say, I remember him because he took the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up working, the last we heard of him, he was working as an IRS. And he had grown up, he had gone to 2 meetings. And the funny thing I remember is because he was raised back east in a Jewish neighborhood. He wasn't Jew, but he was raised in that influence. And every time we had a meeting, you know, because I had to feed these people after. And the easy thing to do, because you had, you know, the wooden coal stoves, okay? And, of course, it's cold weather, because they're in November and December or February or whatever. So each time I would make this big pot of rice in a roast pan and broth and onions and then pork chops on top, stick it all in the oven, and then go to the meeting, you know, a couple hours, and then walk home, and then pull this big pot, you know, this roast, and then set out the plates, and by that time, the other people had come, you know, Kay and Grant Newman, whoever came down from Fairbanks, and you'd feed them. And Grant, growing up in a Jewish neighborhood, kind of had an attitude toward pork. And the next time, in the next meeting, he got the same menu. And that's when he acknowledged to me that, you know, but he was hungry. I mean, he ate, you know, like I say,
and
even if
and he's polite.
But and he acknowledged he does have this attitude yeah. toward poor. And I understood it because I know, you know, myself, in the Native world, there are some women in the villages will eat bear meat. Mm. But in some villages, it's taboo
right.
for a woman.
It's not allowed. Right.
Yeah, and you know, like I say, I am aware of, you know, certain attitudes, you know.
Okay. And well, so that March meeting, you weren't there. I'll ask
and,
Al about it.
Yeah, Al would know.
Yeah.
Al would know more a memory of that. Yeah.
But the idea of that was to start planning and organizing.
Well, right. It was the idea for it come out of the Minto. There was Nenana
okay.
and then Minto meeting. Nenana meeting, and that is when those guys that Robert Charlie, who mm-hmm. was Minto, was on his way to Minto, but he is married to a woman in Tanacross.
Right.
And he was with David Lawrence. And They saw the lights in the Native Hall and caught the tail end of the first land meeting. Right. Do you think anybody else? And he said, well, Minto.
Right.
And well, do you think that? Yes. And so that was the February meeting, and that's when Mary Alice Miller right. and Tom Snap were
right.
present.
Right.
And then that led to the notion of maybe other villages would be interested, and that led to the March meeting. And that meeting is where the memory, and of course I'm sure Minto are the ones that brought it up, about the traditional congressional site where they congressed was right. New Chilliwaya site, right. which meant where the two rivers meet. And right. So that is why that got selected.
Okay.
And how.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now we've got the...
All the needle
all
here, the needle
pieces.
And the thread, yes.
Great,
yes.
Puts it all in.
Mm-hmm. And okay, way. Now we need to back up because the Inupiat Paiute.
Right, that was in
got
61.
Got into it. Why the. Before that first chief's meeting.
Yeah, Inupiat Paiute was November 1961.
That
according
was,
to
Charlie
my notes.
Was at that meeting.
Your dad, Charlie.
Charlie Purvis, yeah.
Okay.
And
I don't know how
but
much
but before okay now we're into 60 okay
right
and then in 61 like I say the Project Chariot thing got Howard Rock mm-hmm. and Laverne Madigan up north
right
and I cannot tell you how they heard about us I cannot tell you.
Yeah, just, had they heard about you or you heard about them?
Maybe that part I don't know because Charlie lived in Fairbanks.
Right.
Because Charlie was at the Inupiat Paiute.
Right.
And which is in Kotzebue.
Right.
And no, there was
it in Kotzebue or was it in Barrow? I think it was in Barrow.
Well, they organized it in Barrow, but I know Charlie attended a Inupiat Paiute meeting that was held in Kotzebue.
Well, I have in my notes that in October of 1962, so that would have been after the first chief's meeting,
okay,
there
maybe
was a
that's
Kotzebue conference on Native rights, which was different from Inupiat Paiute.
No, they called it Inupiat Paiute, that meeting.
Maybe it was the...
And, you know, like there... Okay, the... Oh, God, I don't remember if Howard Rock was at the first chief's meeting. Do you remember?
Yes, he was.
He was. That's what
I think there's a picture of him.
Okay.
At that
okay,
62.
So maybe that is when we first hear about Paiute. And that's... okay, yeah, it had to be. It had to be because... Before our first meeting, Kay came to Nenana.
Right.
And like, you gotta back up a little and understand, Charlie's world was different than my world.
Mm-hmm.
He's in contact with Kay. She's
in,
at the
he's
university.
In, he's in Fairbanks by this point.
He's in Fairbanks, right. He lives here.
Right.
And there is no road between Nenana and Fairbanks yet. You gotta understand.
Right. Just the railroad.
Well, cat trail.
Was
Winter Road.
Was the railroad going?
Oh, yeah. Railroad, always. But anyway, there is no, you know, like I say, that Fairbanks had their world, Nenana
right.
had their world. And unless you got on a train or a plane in the winter, or which was rarely by that time dog team.
Right.
But, I mean, dog team was still used. I remember, what's his name? Jimmy, Andy Jimmy, used the dog team because it was 60 below and the planes couldn't fly to bring a sick child from Minto to Fairbanks. He used dog team and 60 below weather to save a child's life. I remember him doing that. And he must have had to break trail too. Because like I say, you know, before, there's a certain period where dog teams were still pretty used when I first come to Nenana and the trails were still
right.
there. And
snow machines didn't come in.
Yeah, snow machines weren't even in the picture
right.
at all. Right.
Right.
And then like I say, I forget what year there was the cat trail from Nenana to Fairbanks. And and that, I don't know, God, I mean, I don't know how to put it. I forget when they put the ferry in. Do you remember the ferry?
Across the, before the bridge was built across the Tanana?
Because they built Clear.
Oh,
remember?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then because of Clear, then they put the ferry.
Oh,
and then there was more of a year-round road.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember my first trip, I think, going to the Fairbanks on that old cat trail was with Uncle Hank, or Dan, in that pickup truck.
Mm.
Remember, you were riding behind, and I was jumping on the seat. You said,
"Oh, and Dan was that you bounced the whole time."
Those old
trucks.
And what year might that have been?
You were a little guy.
Probably 60, 60, 61, somewhere around
there. You were maybe 3 or 4.
So
not earlier than 59.
Right. So, bringing up the Inupiat patois.
Okay, and timing.
The timing isn't, I can figure that
right.
out.
Right, I just want to clarify. Okay, back to Charlie attended.
Right.
Okay, first of all, it was not a organization created by the Inupiat.
Okay.
The Point Hope people had called. Contacted Howard, and I don't know how they got a hold of him, because like I say, we're talking a whole different technology and time. Whatever we had in Fairbanks, Nenana was way before what they had in Point Hope.
Right.
How they got a hold of Howard when they heard, and how in the hell they even heard that they wanted to drop a bomb in their harbor. And they contacted Howard. And then, fortunately, Howard was in New York with this little outfit called Association for American Indian Affairs, which nobody up here had ever heard of, that I'm aware of, at that era.
Right.
In the meanwhile, she comes in with Howard, finds out at Point Hope what's going on. And then comes to Barrow, and they create, and they gave a name for it, and they kind of appointed people to, I don't know if Howard helped her appoint. Okay, they had a meeting, and Inupiat Paiute means people's heritage,
mm-hmm.
and to talk about people's heritage. And that meeting, then they had another one in Kotzebue, and it might have been like a year later.
Yeah.
Because I do know they met in Barrow. They came down and met with us before our land claim meeting in Tanana. Kay knew that we had that meeting in March. And I would say they came down maybe April. And that was Guy Akakak, who was a reporter for Barrow, he sent in, I think, a weekly column to the News Miner,
mm-hmm.
Howard Rock and Kay and Laverne Madigan. That's the first time I met Laverne.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kind of met. We didn't really talk land claims. It was, I don't know exactly why they came down and came to my house. Maybe they met with your dad somewhere, because I just remember meeting them. And then I remember, what I distinctly remember is, as they're going out the door to leave, which they being Guy Akakak and Howard Rock and Laverne, okay, they might be able to help fund us with Tanana Chiefs. And, money was, so crucial.
Right.
I mean, none of us had money. Villages, net cash was just... If it wasn't for Coghill's credit, and I'm not kidding you, we could not have done land claims.
Hmm.
If it wasn't for Coghill's credit.
Hmm.
because we had no money. In the summer, we'd try to earn enough money to pay the bill, you know, and that's...
Eventually did.
Right.
Oh, we always paid the bills. Right.
But as you say, I mean, you mentioned, you know.
They carried us as far as our family, right. You know, and they carried the whole town.
Right.
And like I say, later on, and I know it because their dad worked for them, 4 years in a row, that family mortgaged their home with the bank in order to buy winter supplies to feed all of us.
Wow.
They asked us to try to keep our budgets within $25 a week, period. And I did. I mean, I knew they were burdened. I knew, you know what I mean? But most people didn't know that.
Right.
Lots and the only Campbell reason soup. I know it.
Lots of Campbell soup.
I know it is because his dad worked at Coggill's part-time. It was not a full-time. He's happened to be working there. I don't know why he's helping Bob. But anyway, the accountant was down. And the accountant was hollering at Bob, "You are not a non-profit organization. You have got to..."
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, and during that, somehow...
As you say, all of you in those early days who were so involved with land claims, you did it out of pocket, and there wasn't money, which makes it even more amazing.
Oh, it is amazing.
Because there wasn't
I don't know
money.
How we did it. And yeah. Like I say, I know Charlie sold the land in Kansas.
Okay.
That's part of the money he got to rent that plane for that first trip. Hmm. From when he sold the land in Kansas. And
you mentioned Grant Newman
and Grant, I don't know how they picked him up, but they
formed the Alaska Native Rights Association.
Indian Rights Association, IRA.
Well, Alaska why, Indian Rights
Which is
Association.
Like the Irish Republican Army. No, no, no.
No. So that was your dad, Charlie and Kay and
Well,
Sandy
I don't think
Grant?
Kay was that involved. They pulled her in because I don't know how the heck Roger... I mean, I knew... Why am I saying Roger? I knew that Charlie knew her from her husband. Mm-hmm. That in the Alaska Independence Party.
Right.
Right. So, and he knew that she had come to Fairbanks so she could get a teaching degree.
Right.
And that's,
after he died.
And he knew where she lived. And but she was so busy. She had a child.
Right.
Her youngest son was a teenager and had to provide. Yeah. And
but so they formed the IRA.
So Charlie somehow, and I don't know who the they would be.
Right. I know it was Charlie.
I know it was Charlie and who he would and have you, had to your... call it a they.
Yeah. Well, I know the names I've seen.
I never attended an Indian Rights Association meeting.
But do you
know why
your dad got started to?
Oh, he was. Oh,
was
God,
that like
we
for
are really jumping ahead?
I know.
No, we're not.
Okay, because in the middle here.
Okay.
In the middle.
Well, I was wondering when the IRA was.
Here is this farm boy. Mm-hmm. He's seen people in hunger and starvation. Right. He knows their culture and been
right.
pretty blown up. So he urged them, and this is way before land claims.
Right.
But not totally way before ALSTAR. He's introduced to ALSTAR, introduced to the concept, promised Al he'd do all he could to help. In the meanwhile, though, another avenue he was going on was getting individuals to file homestead.
Native allotments.
Before homestead. Okay.
Homestead. Not a native allotment.
Okay.
And the reason because the native allotment is under the Department of Interior. You are regulated by the Department of Interior with a native allotment. Number one, you've got to get permission from them if you want to sell it.
Okay,
because
right.
that's under the reservation system.
Right.
Okay. In the meanwhile, homestead get clear 20 acres, file homestead, and also he created a corporation, and I saw it. The credential, you know, the remember how when you're selling stock, the stock, okay. I remember seeing that whole book, and anyway, it was going to be not money, but sweat equity or assets would count as ownership of stock. Okay. And he was able to, okay, Helen Williams, Helen and Nat Williams, he got them to file. Right. He got one or two Minto people to file. And I don't remember their name.
Once he filed,
and then I think maybe Andy Nikolai and Amelia maybe were filed, and he filed. And I think he got Frank Alexander to file too. Okay, so this is. I don't know when he pulled that together. Maybe 53, 54 before okay. I'm married, but I'm not sure, even though I lived at home. Right. He had his life, I had my mom, you know, right. even though
Do you remember the name of this corporation?
No.
Okay.
And he incorporated, and that was his notion.
Okay.
And in the meanwhile, I got married. Worked 1 year on the docks. The first year we're married. Then we went to ferry for the winter, came back. That's when they heard that your dad had studied accounting. I'm pregnant with you. I'm not sure if your dad worked as a bookkeeper on that when I had you as a baby, or was it the next year? I'm not sure when that happened.
Well, I think it was the next year.
I suspect that too. I suspect he was a dock worker. And in the meanwhile, Charlie is up there doing that thing with his corporation. Mm-hmm. Because by the time Alec is born, we were up there. We being you, mm-hmm. remember Nat yeah. Williams?
Right.
He's 2 years old, mm-hmm. 2.5 when we moved up about August. And I had Roger and I had Alec. Three kids under 2 years. Well, 2 years.
Three boys under 2 years.
Three boys. And all, like I say, he's 2.5. And yeah. then Alec was born in May. So he's about 3-4 months, you know. And, of course, we're living in the tents. And now Al never filed, but we were up there, number one, living off the land. So we wouldn't be living off of Coghill. And you know the site halfway between Enana and Fairbanks? You've been down that Enana-Fairbanks highway?
On the road?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When you go about halfway, you'll see a bit...
Just before Skinny Dicks.
Skinny Dicks, yeah.
Yeah, just before... Okay. That's the only place that has water in that area. That's where Charlie had people file.
Okay.
Okay. And his vision was the river is about 3 miles away, and I forget how far the railroad tracks were, maybe a mile away. And then there's the highway, three transport areas, right. and water. Anyway, why am I telling you this story? Oh, well, mostly because of the corporation. And that is... That's the year that that next door house burned, when those three kids burned up. Mm-hmm. And that is when it got, dropped down 20 or something below in October. And we're, anyway, it was really cold, and we were in a horrible army tent. Poor army people. And white tents are okay to live in the winter, but not an army tent. Anyway, we ended up having to load up, you kids, and all of us went in and planted ourselves in Mom's house in Hamilton Acres. And it's a good thing.
This somehow is leading us to the Indian Rights Association.
Well, and I never went to any meetings. But in that period, around that time, and of course the union thing is still going. And of course we eventually moved into one of those little cabins, that one room cabin.
Here in Fairbanks.
Here in Fairbanks for the winter, the rest of the winter. And we spent 2 winters there. We'd go back to Indiana in the summer. The strike was still going on. And Charlie was doing that, and Nat Williams got TB, so he inherited Helen. He had to help provision Helen, supplement food, you know, like oatmeal and stuff like that, so she could stay on her homestead. At some point, though, she left for a period of time, maybe went to Nenana, and a family filed on her claim using that she hadn't proved up on it in the approved times. Mm-hmm. And that forced Charlie to dig in law, which he did. And of course, from that homestead status and jurisdiction of law, thanks to Al Starr, a hint of something called Aboriginal rights, then he had to dig into law of the US and educate himself on Aboriginal law. And if that crucial thing, the worst thing that could have happened, is the best thing. Mm. That is why the Chinese know bad news is always opportunity. That's what that symbol stands for. Because that forced him to do what he wouldn't have bothered doing. Mm-hmm. And he become pretty well educated in Aboriginal law.
Yeah.
And he secured her land, the 160 acres, under allotment status. She didn't lose it. That's why they still have it. So that's been a lot of time fighting for that.
Yeah.
But then he got educated. And, of course, he's got that other organization going up here. He educates himself. He educates them.
Right.
And Kay then needed a thesis.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And so she knew where to start digging.
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah.
So anyhow, hon, like I say, there's just so much...
The archives has a copy.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
These individual people...
Yeah.
...who were nobodies, no status, some of them very unschooled... Which in the white man's world, if you're uneducated, is their word. That means somehow you don't know nothing. You're a blank sheet. You're whatever. And anyhow.
It's as you said.
But he always knew how to weave in and use them educated, credentialed people.
Yeah. Well, you said to me on the phone yesterday something that was very important, I think, that... It shows that everybody, you know, everybody can make a compromise.
Everybody. was so valuable. Kay was so valuable. She had nothing.
Right. And that you think I can't Sandy, do anything.
Sandy Jensen. Yeah. And that teacher, that one right. teacher. Never discount your influence.
That's it.
Never, ever, whoever you are, be you.
Yeah.
Be your truth.
And that there were all these, everybody made some little thing.
One little, yeah, this person, that little school teacher does not know she led right. to a path that become Angstka.
Yep, yeah.
You know what I mean? And Charlie's little corporation, he had he never connected it. He yeah. never connected
not really.
The dots until some point after land claims. Did he see, oh my God, corporation all over.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was, you know, he had never, ever, like I say now, there's a later point before, like when Kay, you know, at some meeting, I don't know, Al maybe knows the details of what meeting that was, which forced Kay then to agree, or maybe Sandy typed it, I'm not sure. At one point, Sandy got fired by the Association of American Indian Affairs. Now, Sandy, Kay is going to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy, where the hell did Candy get involved? Must have been the Indian Rights Association.
Yeah.
She must have gone to that. And I think she was at the second chief's meeting, not the first, because Claribel was the secretary mm-hmm. at the first one. So Sandy may have come down to the second Tanana Chiefs meeting as in the role of secretary. I know she was there. And she was, in that meanwhile, served as that liaison from Al Ketzler, needed to send letters to the Association of American Indian Affairs. He'd communicate with Sandy what his concern was. You know, over the phone, mm-hmm. Sandy had whipped up the letters and the communication, and of course, Al would get the letters. And so Sandy was that little Fairbanks conduit for these communications.
So how come he was having Sandy do that and you weren't doing that?
Sweetheart, I am got five kids. I've got, you know.
Well, you were so active early
not,
on.
I'm not in Fairbanks, and I couldn't conduit with the Fairbanks people.
Oh, okay.
You know, I yeah. cannot. You know, transportation, we didn't have a car, you know. I mean, we're almost isolated
yeah.
with our little lack of money, lack of the road. The bridge wasn't built till.
It just shows how important those
allies
were.
Yeah, like I say, those little, you know,
right.
I mean, a widow, and she was probably getting, Al would maybe know how much, but it was a meager stipend.
Yeah, right.
But it meant something for her.
Oh,
she
so
was
she
a widow.
She did get a little money.
Yeah, she was a widowed woman.
Well, you talk a lot about your dad, Charlie's role and involvement. What about your mother? Was she involved at all?
My mother was a victim of all of it. And I'm not kidding you in the sense that, oh, hon.
You said they spoke a different language.
Oh, they spoke a different language. And my mom...
She tolerated it. You know.
But she was not involved at all.
Not peripheral. And she was involved because she's married to my
right.
damn dad. And that is why she didn't even... You know, that's her involvement. And I mean, hon, she had resentment.
Mm-hmm.
Because she would have liked him to be putting the energy he had into her family. She had three more children. I'm out of the picture. I'm married. I got my own world. I'm the oldest. So, and my sisters were 5 and 6 years
yeah.
younger.
Yeah.
And my brother's 13 years
wow.
younger. And she would have loved to have had a fine Fairbanks house. I'm not saying a mansion,
mm-hmm.
but definitely an upgrade from where she was living in. There in Hamilton Acres, which was he acquired a lot in Hamilton Acres at the close to the Trainer Gate area
mm-hmm.
and hauled in something. Well, he didn't haul it in, but some of his carpenter co-workers had got a surplus building at the base.
Oh, right.
And they hauled it in, and I don't think it was on a foundation or anything. And then Mom won it out of Nenana in 56. I married in 55. Well, she left a year later of Nenana. And these carpenter friends, three of them, had acquired that house, and they won it $6,000 for it. Now, Dad got mad at her because I think he had told her to offer $4,000, that it wasn't worth six. Or maybe he told her to offer three. Maybe he figured they should each get $1,000 and that'd be fair. But anyway, she didn't argue with him because she didn't feel she had anything to negotiate. And she paid the whole $6,000 for it. And I mean, it was a surplus building. And it did get hooked up to sewer and water. She did have running water. So that was an important upgrade for her.
Nice place to me, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, hon, I mean, everybody has their standards. Right. And she was used to much better quality life. Charlie, hon, you cannot understand his hillbilly world. He really wasn't a hillbilly. Like 60 miles south was the real hillbillies.
Right, yeah, you had said that the last time.
I mean, I now know why they called it hillbilly. Yeah. And I mean, to grow a farm on... when your land is perpendicular.
But, so father's focus on land claims took away from the family.
And she did not time, like that. Energy, and even money.
Right.
Yes.
And so that was hard on your mom.
He was heavily involved right up until he left in 68.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents...
It was like his life.
Yeah, did they divorce? Or they stayed
they
together?
They never divorced. There was... from 68 on, they never lived under the same roof. Mm-hmm. But they never divorced. They are not Catholic. I have no idea how to explain their marriage, except they were both forced to it.
Right.
Because they got pregnant with me. And, of course, my mom, I wasn't her favorite daughter because I got her in all this trouble.
But you were like your dad.
I spoke his language.
Right. And so,
and I would stand up to him, and if he threw a sword this way, I could go that way, and man, we could spar. He loved me because I could argue with him.
Well, it's interesting how all of this activity affected people's families and other members of the family. That's kind of what I was
But yet
asking.
My mom was very full of grace. He had these Indian meetings, Indian rites, at her house.
Right. And so she fed everybody.
And she gave them tea and coffee and endured. And then one day, was it first chief meeting or second chief meeting? I guess it's the first one. Because the plane come in with a bundle of newspapers from the news miner. And in the news miner headlines was that the Indian, you know, that's how they put it. I still hate that word. Anyway, we're being spoon-fed at Tanana or something like that. And anyway, mocking the meeting and whatever. And, of course, at the same time, it's about the time when the church was blasting the meeting, and anyway, which is a whole nother story. But anyway, we hadn't left Tanana, we being the whole delegations, you know, from the villages, saw these headlines and were pretty incensed. And we had to get on the plane. So we agreed we'd have a meeting in Fairbanks to respond. Well, of course, the meeting was held in Mom's house. She had a rather large living room in this house. And she comes home. She's worked as a maid at the Westmark. It wasn't as Traveler's Inn in those days. Right. And opens her door after working all day, and there's about 20... you know, indigenous people in her living room, because some of them had to leave. They had connecting flights. Once we landed in Fairbanks, they couldn't. They all had to get on other planes to get back to the village. And anyway, at least a couple of reporters, I think Tom was there. And having this meeting, responding to the news miner. I mean, my poor mother walks in the door after a holiday's work, and this is what, I mean, you know.
And
I can understand her exactly. Yeah, I can too.
Was she gracious and she made
she acted like it was no big deal. I mean, you know, and I mean, God, I don't know. She probably didn't have a seat to sit down on, you know. But, oh my God.
And so, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead by getting us to the 63 meeting. Bear, did you have something? You wrote down a few things.
Oh, well, I was... these are like Charlie Smith. You know, when I met or communicated with him, he's an old timer. Is my growing up. I don't know.
He was in Nanana?
Yeah, if he made it to 90 or whatever. But had a lot of stories about my grandma and stuff. And it kind of goes back to the time of the different laws that changed. Because he would kill a moose out of season, and he would get picked up by the fishing game, and he'd get shipped to Fairbanks to jail. So he would be fed by my grandmother, who was a matron at the jail.
Oh.
And so he told everybody, God, you know, go to jail, you get nice food. This lady, grandma, you know, Mrs. Purvis, Dorothea Purvis. So those are the kind of stories that I kind of grew up with. Because he actually came to Fairbanks once. He said he was a little destitute, and he broke a window, knowing that he'd get thrown in jail and he would be have a place to stay for the winter, and have the food cooked by my grandmother. And the other thing I wrote down, Chief Andrew Isaac, I forgot what senator, but he went to Washington D.C. to testify, I think in. What was it, 66, 67?
Yeah, like I say, Andrew, the Northway people, you know, Doris Charles and her sister, her daughter-in-law.
Ruth Charles.
Ruth, and were the spokespeople for Northway, Tana Cross area.
Right.
And then after a couple of years, then Andrew became the voice. And so that's kind of... like you say, into the later 60s, the later part.
Right. Because I think it might have been Senator Jackson, but, you know, when he testified, one of the comments by the senator was, you know, thank you so much for coming and testify. He says, I did not realize they were even Native Alaskans in Alaska.
Wow.
I mean, that's how disconnected, you know, Congress or some of the Congress members were.
Yeah,
but he made a definitely impression.
Yeah, well, that reminds me that little film that was on the TV the other night, that Lowell Thomas filmed, that was in 68 in Anchorage at some hearing, an Interior Committee hearing, and they mentioned that Chief Andrew Isaac talked, I think it was him or Chief Northway, explained about what we now call subsistence and the traditional lifestyle and how important the land is to the Native people. And the comment was sort of like, all those guys listening, they were guys, you know, it was just unfathomable to them. They had no concept.
Right.
So I can see going to D.C. would be even more so.
Well, just
and
to
the
go
courage
back.
To get up to testify, that's what, you know. Somebody like
hon,
Chief Andrew
when
Isaac.
When Robert Charlie got up to speak at the first Tanana Chiefs meeting, I mean, Robert Charlie is not a shy man.
Right.
And he was, of course, young man.
Really young.
You know, he's older than me, you know, not by a lot of years, but I don't know, between 5 and 10 years older than me. And he got up to speak for Minto. I mean, I just saw beads of sweat pop out on him. And of course, like I say, knowing Native rule of tribal law and the status of showing respect, etc., and not confronting. I mean, to do in the white man's world where you confront. And, you know, like I say, I mean, psychologically, how difficult that was.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's why when they arrest somebody, you're taught when in Native law, You respect authority.
Right.
Well, under white man's law, you don't have to respect authority. You don't have to. You plead not guilty. You do, you know, whatever. Okay? It's so different.
Yeah.
But, hon, this is the radical thing about Rudy Mead and that legacy, Aboriginal right law from Alexander the Great.
Right.
To Rudy Mead, when those nobles said, wait a minute, you're going to share some power, to the time of Common, when they threw out the kings and they started cutting some heads off, changed the rules.
Right.
Well, where a man, and there for a long time, a man, even law, did not break into a man's home. Yeah. They would guard until finally the man would come out. He'd have to get food or provision or water. But, you know, a man's home used to be sacred even under Western law.
Yeah. Well, as you say, that courage and...
And that's
and
what I mean.
Going that against the
so
culture.
So against, yeah. And like when Percy Herbert disappeared.
Oh, he's the one that disappeared.
He's the one that disappeared. And... Oh, call up and down the rivers because he spoke out against Rampart.
The dam.
About the dam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he's the most local at the time.
Yeah, so the suspicion is...
So as far as they're concerned, he got put down.
Yeah.
And they're...
But by the native people?
By the native.
No, by the non-native.
Well, no, not by the native. But I mean the native people. By the native people, that was their beliefs, the white... Put him down.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, that is, we deal with that a lot.
Right. Well, that's what I say. I mean, the whole land claims early, the whole period, but the early throughout all, just, yeah, what it took for people to speak out and
hold ground.
And hold ground.
Yeah.
And I don't know how one explains that. I guess you have to ask
the
individual
people.
Well,
you just try to get some white men together and go down and talk to Congress. How hard that is for them.
Yeah, when they had no money. I mean, just,
yeah.
And again,
I mean, even though they might have funds or whatever, you can, I've dealt with miners up here.
Yeah.
In fact, that's one reason my husband was attracted to me. He knew, and he would introduce me. Oh, she used to be married to Al Ketzler. As if I had some kind of connection, conduit, into shaping Congress up.
Right. Well, you
because they had problems with the... Oh, okay, white man's law.
Right.
With the miners up here. And I told them what they had to do. And you know what? They're scared to. I have lived with white men now longer than any culture in my life with white men. I am shocked at how afraid of their government they are. I am not kidding you. I am not kidding you. And this is what's scary. I kind of see why they thought Trump is a solution.
Oh. Well, we're not going to go
and
there.
And we can't go there. But you know, like I say, I am blown away by whites.
That courage and determination, and I think the only answer is to ask the individual people, you know, so I could ask, you know, why people were able to do what they did, and that's a question for your dad, you know, and because it is really amazing.
Oh, like I say, hon, when we filed that injunction on the pipeline, oh my God. That's way later. That's when
we filed
the injunction on
the pipeline. Oh, the land freeze and all that.
It's a long story. But
we haven't gotten there yet.
We ain't even there. But, you know, the blast and, you know, the reporters calling up, wanting to know, you know, and of course, I mean, Al is just trying to live at home. He's at home. Picks up the phone and, okay, he's, you know, like with Bear sitting there. And that phone conversation, then I'd watch a huge bump come out. Mm-hmm. Maybe then another bump. And I mean, the stress. Yeah.
The hives.
I mean,
hives. Yeah. Oh, he would break
Emil
into hives.
Got to a point. Emil could not fly on a plane to go to D.C. for meetings.
Because of the stress?
The stress. It a funny, like my little daughter-in-law, she wasn't a daughter-in-law. She was Charlie Ketzler's wife. My little
sister.
Wilma, who is another crucial woman I haven't got to.
Okay.
And her, what do you call it, symptom of stress. She, okay, number one, Wilma is this wonderful. She's Wilma Earhart Sunnyboy. Her mother was an Earhart from Tanana. Her father is a Sunnyboy from Mary, St. Mary's. Mm. And her mother and father met in Tanana, which they have their wonderful story. But anyway, they met in Tanana and married. And then moved to Nenana. And Wilma was originally my sister's friend because they were the same age, 5 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And they were little buddies. But then my sister moved to Fairbanks when my mom did. And then Wilma ended up marrying Dan Ketzler, my brother-in-law, kind of adopted son, not formally adopted. He married the woman who had Charlie, but Charlie became a Ketzler. Charlie is really a Gundrum, but the father was a Gundrum. But anyway, he, you know, he became a Ketzler by aware of osmosis.
Adoption.
Yeah,
adoption,
and of course that's
of
a way a lot of kids ended up with a last name. Yeah. So anyway, he's a Charlie Ketzler and he married her. And anyway, as her and I have a whole separate story, but she got involved in land claims. And for her, and I don't know what you'd call it, it's stress related. Manifested itself in fear of dog. Hmm. She'd see a little tiny chihuahua or something a block away and get frozen with fear. And this is a little woman. She's narrow, you know, her mother was smaller than her in small, like Elizabeth when she was a young one was cuter and just a small little thing. And Wilma was short because her father was short too. Mm-hmm. But yet a strong woman. I mean, you know, not like, anyway, she used to hook up dog teams. She hooked up dog teams.
Right. And then she
ran a dog team.
Then she became afraid.
And then would spot a loose dog or something and she would become frozen. And that's how it manifested for her.
Interesting.
Now, I know two men. I can't think of his first name. The last one is Don Peters. And the last name was Wallace, and it wasn't like Tim Wallace. No. He was a different Wallace. It's a W-A-L-A-C-E. I forget his name. Your dad might remember his first name. But both of them manifested. I mean, it was around the same time, but they got involved with land claims for about a year and could not do it because their blood pressure and et cetera. Anyway, what manifested was bloody noses, huge bloody noses, the stress, just they couldn't do it. I mean, they were only in for about a year and not even deeply compared to where Emil and, you know, your dad and stuff like that, you know. And you know, I thought come to me, I wasn't going to express it, but it's worth expressing because it hurts. They were on a front line, Emil and Al Ketzler for years. And they talk about Vietnam, there was no homecoming. Oh, has Emil ever got a thank you?
Probably not.
Well,
I know Al Senior hasn't.
Yeah, I think Emil and Willie and some of those people now, I don't know if they've gotten a thank you, but they're now with these anniversaries, they at least get their names recognized and they give speeches.
That don't put any food on the table.
No, and the Al Ketzlers and all these other people,
I like to say, hon, I don't even know if they get that. If they do, it's kind of like Rasmussen. Years ago when, not Rasmussen, Edmundsen, and one of those other explorers.
Oh, for the North Pole who gets the credit?
Well, no. Oh. They did this arduous thing, and there was no banquets for them. So anyway, they went back to Denmark and threw their own banquet. And that's what they need to do. They need to go throw their own banquet.
Well, you mentioned...
But like I say, I mean, it's just that is like... there is what I saw before. Mm-hmm. That was horrible. And yet on the after, it's just about as horrible. I mean, like I say...
That's a good thing to talk about. Yeah, what... I don't want to skip us ahead.
I know. I'm way miles away now from the beginning.
Exactly. So all this effort for land claims and the passage of ANCSA, what do you think of the results?
It's still horrible and just as treacherous as before. And they don't really understand various eddies and dynamics that seek to undermine. Ooh.
Yeah, I think it's
because
a lack of education, and they, you know, like
I would not call it education.
Lack of whose education?
The leadership education, okay. And this is all around Alaska.
Well, whites and natives, the total ignorance of all of them. Because of the lack of education, even in the United States, hon, you don't understand. When I went to school, I learned about civics. Mm-hmm. Civics was a curricula.
Right.
They don't even know the word civics in this country anymore. White and native and black don't understand the rules of the game. And they don't understand the procedure to play the game. If you want to get in football, you got to know the rules of the game. You got to know the procedure to get in. You got to understand the board. They've got baseball, football, soccer ball all mixed up, and they call it politics, hon. It's insanity.
Right. So what you're saying, it's not so much the law itself, but it's how people have been implementing it and interpreting it.
Right. Probably by 83 or 84, which is like 10 years after, a little over 10 years after the ANCSA, I interviewed like Ruth Charles, almost on her dying bed. And, and Chief Van der Isaac was there as well. And their perception of what they were fighting for and to where it had come to was, you know, that's when I started recognizing there's a big difference here. You know, and it was just the way that a lot of it was that they felt just that the original kind of intentions and all the effort went into it. It didn't wheedle down to the people. I mean, and part of that is that the mechanism they picked with the corporations and the lack of understanding of the corporations, you know, because corporations, you can make change, and they just seen the corporations as unchangeable, you know, thing, you know. I remember Ruth was saying that somehow the word got out in the Native community that Morris Thompson, who was the president at that time, had just started becoming, or he just hired as president, and his salary was like $130,000 a year, and it was just blew her mind, like, that's not the Native way.
Right.
That's a lot of, that could feed a lot of people in the villages, that could help build schools, and that was what's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And so the older people that I've seen, kind of thought that the leadership had lost its way.
Yep, it was totally perverted. Yeah. And so was the American way. Yeah. The same perversions.
So I, and when I traveled downriver, like old Johnny Deacon, he was probably in his 90s when I met him. He was raised in the mission in Holy Cross. And his solution was, we got to build the missions again and get these kids to learn how to live off the land, how to grow potatoes.
Yeah, right. Get to real. Get real again.
Get back to real again. That's right. What we need. Mm-hmm. We need, obviously, you know, he wasn't sexually abused and nothing. People probably wouldn't have said that. Other villages I'd go to, I met sexually abused men and women. But anyway, that was his, you know.
Well, he had been in the mission and had...
He was raised in the mission and he had learned
felt like to,
he could raise cattle, he could raise horses, he could hunt. I mean, he had to do everything, and he could plant potatoes. He was
Holy Cross planted a lot of potatoes.
Yes. Holy Cross mission was pretty self-sustaining.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Using both worlds.
Yeah.
The indigenous and the agricultural world.
Yeah.
And about four little nuns ran it.
Mm-hmm. There was a priest there, I think, too.
There were priests, but the nuns are the ones that were the major, you know. Now, I'm sure the priests worked outdoors with the boys, you know. But those little nuns kept them, I think, 40 girls or something.
I can't remember.
I wouldn't know. I was not there.
No, I wasn't either, but I've interviewed people about it.
Well, I have one friend who was there, and I had a recent dialogue with her, and that's the number she threw. There were four nuns keeping track and managing in a very never physical, well, I don't think she said physical. I don't think she narrated. Whatever, there was a consequence, but it was related to the inappropriate behavior. Whatever, like, anyhow, like she was, what was confusing, again, for me, coming back to the country and trying to sort it out. The kids coming out of Holy Cross hated it. They considered it like a jail. They hated it. They hated it. I meet her. She left and went to the Lower 48. I mean, not, you know.
Right.
We were opposite. I'm coming and living in Alaska. She goes to the Lower 48. Years later, we meet. And she had this different posture about her Holy Cross experience. And recently, just about 4 or 5 months ago, I had a chance to pin her down. And, well, you know, your narrative when you were a kid and this. And she said what they taught her, her first thing was stability.
Right.
There was a consistency every morning. This was done.
Yep.
And there's, and it was... The stability was created by you planting the potatoes, you fishing, by you sowing, by you made your, you know what I mean? But now there was, in this current narrative, also some resentments. She knows of things that were given, to be given to the kids, that would be put over here for sale. And these are things. And she said one time a gift giver subverted the whole agenda. A whole big container of bubble gum. And each child was handed by this the bubble gum, and they got it. It didn't get over here for sale.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so, like I say, that was her only, you know, but again... You know, cash is king.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they needed cash. I'm not going to say I judged that because I didn't talk to the administrators.
Yeah, they probably did to run a mission.
Yeah.
Can we take a little bit of a pause?
You need it, yeah.